or in the R.
You know, so that's, we do need to do things differently. That doesn't mean we don't want a very cooperative relationship with China. It doesn't mean we don't want to do business with China. We want both of those things. But we also have to be mindful of the competition, and that's, I think, where the administration is right to put emphasis on. But Bob's right, certainly, can we learn to do it intelligently, not just because we like disruption. It shouldn't be just about disruption.
Echoing Patrick's point, I mean, I don't think there's any shift in U.S. recognizing that the U.S.-China relations has both elements of cooperation and competition. I mean, Secretary Mattis's comments in Shangri-La does mention the desire for cooperation with China. But as Patrick mentioned, I mean, I think the change is seeing China not just as a competitor, but a strategic competitor, and responding to things that China is doing in the strategic competition space, such as responding to the Made in China 2025 plans. I'm not endorsing the way that we've chosen necessarily to respond to it, but we are seeing a response to things that we haven't seen before. On the Chinese side, I think there's a concern about both the uncertainty of the administration, but also what is in what they see in, as disengagement from this administration, actually. So things like the being uninvited to RIMPAC, restricting certain scholarly exchanges and academic exchanges, ability of Chinese students to study in the United States in certain academic disciplines. I mean, they are concerned that this is a broader move towards disengagement, and for both sides, I think if we do see greater disengagement, that reduces, I think, the leverages and incentives for both sides to change and to cooperate.
This is a very good question. Just a couple of points. Number one, my experience in talking with people outside of Washington, that this is very much a Washington situation. One thing I do here is when the new incoming students come, the accepted students to the Elliott School, I get to give them a lecture on China. I do this, I do this three times. So I maybe 350 people collectively that I talk with. And so I chose to look at the national security strategy, the national defense strategy, and explain it to everybody what this meant and so forth. And these are people who, these are students who know international affairs, they're coming in, and their parents. And they're, you know, people who are paying their tuition. They haven't a clue as to what I'm talking about. They have no idea what this means, this whole Washington thing. Why, well, you don't like China? Why don't you like China? You know, this type of thing. And so this is very much here. Very active, heated here. But where else, I don't know. I'd urge you to go out in the countryside, and go to San Francisco. go, but I mean, it's just not there. And so this is, so I don't think we have a sea change yet. The Gallup polls looking at China show that the American people like China a little bit better this year than they liked them last year. Not great, but a little bit better. And I think that's a reality check that we need to keep in mind. But the ferment here is very powerful. And so I think it's more negative than Patrick indicated. We're all doing our own temperature checks. And I spend more time with Congress, I guess. But the Congress is really heated on these issues. And so I think and competition is fine, but the Chinese do it dirty. And that's the problem. Xi Jinping is duplicitous. They look like they're doing something and they don't do it. Time and again. We have agreement fatigue with China. With all these, we've had IPR agreements with China since 1992. They don't do it. And so this kind of thing, so competition isn't it. I mean, it is, but it's competition in all sorts of ways. This United Front stuff is what the CIA used to do in Europe in the Cold War. That's what they're doing. Do we want to get back into that game? I don't think so. And so the point is that's what I'm getting at. I think there's a real attitude that what do they want? And I think it's gotten quite serious. And so on the economic side, the most serious thing I can see is this whole quest of China to control these advanced technological industries that represent the sinews of American power. The national security strategy says this kind of stuff is a national security interest. It's a national security matter. And if the Chinese, they're buying up these companies, they're now at the point they use cyber theft in the past, they, I guess they don't have to use it so much, they just buy the companies. And they just buy it. And the Americans watch this take place, and that builds up their capability to control these key areas of the economy. What happens if they dominate those areas? How close are we to that? These are the kinds of questions I see, and I've heard people talk about. To me, it seems quite serious. So that's where I think we are right now. And it's gotten worse. It's just got progressively worse, as far as I can see.
Katie Wong with NTD TV. I have a question about Kim Jong-un, his recent visit, this visit to China, the third visit. Yeah, China kind of high profile in their reporting about this visit. And so I want to see, what do you see China's role in the upcoming weeks or months in this denuclearization process of this North Korea? And also, especially with the escalating of U.S.-China trade relations. Will China be cooperative or more an active role in this upcoming months?
Well, I've been very impressed with some conclusions that I've drawn tentatively about China and North Korea in the last few months of my many trips and conversations, and some of these are in my report that's issued on Thursday. But first of all, the depth of the estrangement between Beijing and Pyongyang between 2012 and 2017 was deeper than I had realized. The distrust, so the people historically talking about the lips and teeth relationship, this was not the relationship between Xi Jinping and Kim Jong-un. There's a reason why Kim Jong-un only in 2018 made three visits to China, and that is because of the level of deep distrust and animus. And I can't go into the details, but you know, you can read about them in some places. secondly, when Kim Jong-un decided to pivot to diplomacy for a variety of reasons, technical achievement, sanctions could be about to bite or in the future really hurt his economy, diplomatic opportunity made by President Moon, especially using the Olympics, Americans' unpredictability in this case, including the possible bloody nose strategy. All of these things contributed to Kim's judgment to pursue diplomacy beginning 1 January, and that's led to China and North Korea to make up quickly, because they both need each other. They don't like each other, but they both need each other. China, thirdly, was caught off guard by, and the whole world was caught off guard, even the White House was caught off guard when the President walked out at the White House that day and said, "I'm going to the summit with Kim Jong-un." But the Chinese really scrambled. I mean, they were practically shipping coal to Pyongyang to make sure the train started running. This third trip, by the way, Kim Jong-un flew. He's obviously feeling comfortable on China air now. It is an interesting sort of development that he's, at the same time, Kim Jong-un is making peace with the American president, his forsworn long enemy. He's also making up very fast with Xi Jinping. But Xi had promised a trip to Pyongyang. That hasn't happened yet. Instead, we see a smaller power going to Beijing, the Middle Kingdom here, three times in a row. Reportedly, Kim has asked for tens of millions of dollars of investment. And that's a drop in the bucket in terms of China's Belt and Road Initiative kind of numbers that they've bandied about these years. But at the same time, it would be a significant change if this were to happen. So I think Kim is serious about economic development, but he also is wary about over-dependency on China. So this dance that's going on between Kim and Xi is for your consumption, and it betrays the real story behind the scene, which is much more complex, where Kim is balancing the major powers, and she is also balancing the United States with a close relationship with Kim. Final point, China has to play a key role in any peace process, in the nuclear process. It cannot be marginalized. And there must be a more coherent multilateral aspect to any serious roadmap that happens, not just a white on bus. And that's just a matter of realism, because China was not to be sort of marginalized in 1950 when it was, you know, 1 year into the PRC and could ill afford sort of being deflected from the invasion of Taiwan, which it wanted at the time. But in 2018, under Xi thought, and under newfound confidence and power, there's no way that China will not be playing a central role. So that's much of China's scrambling is about that. And it's well understood in the White House, and I think it's well understood in South Korea as well. So I think, you know, China's going to continue to be one of the major players on whatever happens on the diplomatic roadmap. But if this process goes badly on the nuclear dismantlement, as I said, is absolutely essential, it will create a new fissure, possibly between Seoul and Beijing on the one hand and Washington on the other. And then that will be an interesting question, because Kim Jong-un may be able to divide the US-ROK alliance, which North Korea and China would very much agree on.
Nicely
done. Covered all of them. Yeah, right. Hello, I'm Greg Long with the Global Taiwan Institute. I actually want to ask a little bit about competition and about consistency, which are two themes that are coming up at this panel. When we talk about the trade war, actually, and I'm kind of wondering what sort of precedent is being set so far. Just recently, the ZTE acquisition was blocked by Congress, but Trump personally negotiated to try and get that through in the first place. And when Trump's administration was first looking at the region, the first thing they targeted was actually the South Korean-U.S. trade treaty, and then other things such as TPP. And as far as I'm concerned, no waivers for tariffs have been applied to Japan, South Korea, or Taiwan at this point. So when it comes to this trade war, when it comes to the trade relationship with China, is Trump perhaps too focused on the deficit? And what does that exactly mean for multilateral diplomacy in the region when it comes to the USA and its allies, which are going to face down China with in the future? Thank you.
I will just throw in a couple comments, but really others should address this issue. I mean, I think it's well known in the White House that the president does make the trade imbalance question paramount. And that has shaped this administration's trade policy more than anything else, and has also made it different from previous policies because of the fixation on the trade imbalance question. At the same time, you know, when you're selectively picking your data, you know, when Canadian dairy farmers become the major strategic threat, you know there may be something being warped here. So I don't want to make light of it, but the point is that we're in this very surreal reality TV trade show at the moment. And so ZTE can get a pass from the president, even though everybody agrees, no, that's on principle. I was in China 2 months ago, and I heard one brilliant American expert after another who likes to do trade with China saying, look, you understand, there was 6 years this was going on, they violated the rules, there has to be a penalty, this is just how it works. And then the president sort of gives them a pass, and it's like, wow. Now, I don't know what the Chinese are supposed to make of that. That if you, and I think they make of it that if you go to the top and you can make a deal with this president, you can change the law.
Well, that's a great question, and I think one of the issues has been identified is, you know, there are different personalities when it comes to a trade issue. Trump himself is definitely very focused on the deficit, as we can tell by his rhetoric, but, you know, there are others in the administration who manage trade issues, and, you know, they're very focused on issues like IP, even to the extent of sort of the structure of U.S.-China trade and the systems that kind of give rise to that. Another point of confusion, to your point about the competition and consistency, is how these trade issues are being messaged. The ZTE one, I think, caught a lot of people off guard because, you know, we woke up and we saw it on Twitter, for example. So, I mean, there's definitely inconsistencies that's kind of giving rise to more confusion. I don't know whether that's indicative of the internal discussion or whether this is more of a messaging issue. On the waivers, yes, they do put in threat to question U.S. consistency and alliance relationships. In my view, you know, I think some in the administration have seen the waivers as an opportunity to open up discussions for more trade on more trade issues with partner countries. But I do think, you know, we're talking about Taiwan, the fact that Taiwan wasn't able to get an exemption on the steel and aluminium tariffs, I mean, that has been a point that's very concerning. And that's perhaps a very small stone to throw Taiwan, as Bob mentioned. You know, what can we do to improve U.S.-Taiwan relations? And I think that could be an obvious one.
Yeah. This is really unfortunate. It runs against what we want, at least at the national security strategy point of view, working with allies, this type of thing. Obviously, this is very disruptive to the ally relationship. And it reflects the president's proclivity, as has been said. looking at his style in the election campaign, he's a very unconventional guy. He likes tension. He thinks he can take advantage of tension. It's a very different sort of thing. He's not in Angela Merkel. You know, he's just very, very different. And so the point here is we have to get used to this. I mean, it keeps everybody off balance. Maybe he can get a good deal out of this. The guy I look to when I want to make sense of this sometimes is the STR. He obviously wants to take these actions, you know, and he says, well, we're doing this because we want to deal with these people. We think we have an unfair trade relationship. We have good reason to feel that way. And therefore, we want to negotiate with them. And they won't negotiate. So we're going to make them want to negotiate. We're going to do stuff like this. And that means tension and disrupting the order and so forth. To do what? To get a deal with them. That's what he says. And to me, that makes some sense. But in the meantime, everybody's complaining about Mr. Trump, and he's sucking up all the oxygen about whatever the issue is, and he gets all the attention, and his antics just take away from the sense of consistency in American policy. So that's not a good thing, and that's not good for our ally relationship. So we have that kind of a leader. I think that's what it boils down to.
All right. Several hands and not much time left, so we'll take a few more questions and try to wrap it up. So, here first.
I'm Beth from UNC. First of all, thank you for insightful and informative discussion today. And I just arrived to DC, so I'm now learning about the US administration policies and strategies. So, it is a very complex issue. So in my point of view, China has its own strategies and political pressure toward Taiwan. While President Trump's policy towards Taiwan remains unclear, at the same time, Congress encouraged diplomatic contacts between U.S. officials and the Taiwanese. So how do you see the President Trump's policy towards Taiwan? Thank you.
You want to start with that one?
Yeah.
I'm not sure what President Trump's policy is personally for Taiwan. I don't think he's very interested in Taiwan, basically. So I would watch the people in the administration that do have an interest in Taiwan, and there are many of them, and they feel that Taiwan has gotten the short end of the stick over the past decade or two. And they want to do something to improve that situation. So that's what I think. So what is the policy? I think the policy is the One China policy, but it's very broad. And you can move in different directions. And I would watch for movement to improve the relationship with Taiwan. But the areas I can't specify, I don't know exactly. This will be a matter of opportunity. Something's coming up, an approach that can be carried out without undue consequences, negative consequences. That's what I would watch for.
Thank you.
I agree with Bob that this administration seems to continue to uphold the One China policy, and this they've taken public opportunities to reaffirm the Taiwan's Relations Act, which in addition to the three communiques and the six assurances seem to be continuing to provide the guiding framework for this administration's policy. But you know, within this framework, we've seen developments. You know, the Taiwan Travel Act is perhaps a very high profile one, and there's a lot more discussions, at least in the policy community, about what more can we do between the United States and Taiwan. And I think in terms of the international space, the airlines issue with the businesses, I mean, that's something that is increasing in terms of what the U.S. is willing to do sort of indirectly in support of Taiwan. You know, I don't see a lot of I don't see changes to fundamental U.S. policy towards Taiwan. I would say that what we're seeing now is more responses that are viewed sort of incommensurate with, or at least proportional to what the China is doing. So it's more of a reaction in that action-reaction dynamic.
Hi, team. I'm the World Bank. My question is with regard to the role of, if any, other Asian countries, as for instance India, Japan, or Russia, for instance, as the U.S. and North Korea and China have this dynamic going on. What role, if any, are these countries? For instance, in Asia, it's very common for nowadays for India and China to balance the geopolitical situation when it comes to trade, democracy. So those are the two balancing powers. But does it make sense for Taiwan to reach out beyond China to other countries like Japan, India, Russia? Being a devil's advocate, I have no idea about this, but it seems like in the current increasingly globalized post-geopolitical Asia, where countries are moving beyond regional to global and forming alliances beyond their regions, does it make sense for Taiwan to reach out and not just go to China or North Korea? Also more west or east.
Sure, I'll just make a few points. Yes is the short answer, and yes, Taiwan's doing it. The new southbound policy, the petrochemical investment from Taiwan into India is not about competing, but about bringing the economic management skills of Taiwan to a new industry in India to help them develop that part of the economy. And it's seen as a very successful major investment, but it also shows the diversification of the economy that I think President Tsai would like to see go in many different countries, but obviously big emerging strong economies like India. I also think the question of cooperation with Japan. I mean, Japan is, as pointed out on this recent trip, is three times more popular in Taiwan than the United States is, even the United States is this major partner. Prime Minister Abe's policies have been to open up the aperture on both governmental and non-governmental cooperation with Taiwan. That's just for starters, but you can go throughout Southeast Asia, you can look at India, European countries, there are a lot of countries that are very eager to do business and work with Taiwan. Finally, I'll mention the fact that Taiwan's concern here puts it in a very difficult strategic situation over China's renewed campaign for political derecognition. We saw Burkina Faso being chipped off, Panama before that, maybe the Vatican, maybe Gambia. You see the resumption of an earlier contest between Beijing to put pressure on Taiwan by essentially co-opting
countries that are still recognizing Taiwan. And Taiwan is investing in things like official development assistance in these sort of, I won't say losing economies, but in some cases, you know, they are very poor economies like Haiti, Guatemala. And as a result, it's very tough for Taiwan to pay enough and outspend China to keep the political recognition. So one of the ideas here is that Taiwan needs to think more about the non-governmental space and the private sector space. And they are, but their existential fear is that if the ROC identity goes away, that is the basis for the cross-strait relationship. So on the one hand, they need to go in the direction you're talking about, because there's a bright future in it. You can be a very successful. Think of the Gates Foundation or whatever you want. You know, on the other hand, if you're saying, wait, if you're doing away with the existential crisis of doing away with the ROC, then you're undermining the entire basis. So there's a balance here to be struck. They need to both move out with other countries and other non-state actors, but they also need to be mindful of the fact that they exist and have influence because they do have recognition, and that has to be tended to as well. So the answer is to come up with a smarter way to prevent political recognition, and then expand the non-state and commercial side with other actors and countries broadly in this global economy.
That is an excellent question, thank you. So to echo Patrick, yes, the Thai administration has unveiled a new southbound policy, and you know, her predecessors have had similar ambitions of reaching out more towards Southeast Asia. And I think what makes this administration's policy unique is that it's a combination of the econ, but as well as bringing together investment, development, and very importantly, P2P. I mean, that's people-to-people exchanges, and that's sort of been one of the immediate beneficiaries of the new southbound policy, where we're seeing greater tourists from Southeast Asia go to Taiwan, and hopefully that's something that will continue to build. So yes, you know, developing deeper relations with other countries in Southeast Asia, keeping in mind that new southbound includes India as well, so that does help Taiwan diversify away from its dependence on China. And in addition, you know, Taiwan's working with other partners such as the United States. Taiwan and the United States have the Global Cooperation and Training Framework Agreement, which allows the two sides to cooperate in other parts of the region on things like development assistance, on things like women's empowerment, for example. So it's a very wide agenda. And you know, you mentioned Japan. I mean, in addition to what Taiwan and Japan can do together, because I think the relationship between Tsai and Prime Minister Abe is very promising, you know, the next level is thinking about what can Japan and Taiwan, maybe in partnership with the United States, other like-minded countries, maybe India, but what can they do together in other parts of the region, you know, for things like development, infrastructure, aid, and things like that. Yeah, I think I'll stop there.
Just a reminder, when you're dealing with this issue and you're dealing with the Asian countries in general, particularly in Southeast Asia, the ASEAN countries, they have deferred to China on a whole range of issues in the recent years, most recently in the South China Sea. Very sensitive issues for them, but China put the pressure on, they deferred. And so in the case of Taiwan, what you're seeing in airlines and things like that, and other issues, these non-governmental issues, it seems to me, if they get some attention, if the Chinese sees them as important, they will very likely put pressure on these governments. And in that context, I'm not optimistic that the governments will stand up to China on these types of issues. And so it's going to be a tough road for Taiwan, it seems to me, if this becomes meaningful, because Beijing has been just, as we've seen, ratcheting up the pressure. And as far as these countries are concerned, they incrementally, but defer. They defer to China on very sensitive issues. And so I think this is, I'm not too optimistic about this. I see this I don't know how much growth can take place in China, in Taiwan's relationships here, without getting PRC attention, and then they put the pressure on these governments to limit it.
So we're unfortunately out of time. I want to thank you all for a great discussion. These are clearly two issues and areas to watch and be enduring issues for quite some time. So I want to thank GW and the Seeger Center for partnering with us on this. And of course, let's give a round of applause to our great panelists.